23. Of the Island of the Dead. At first it was not easy for the knight and priest to control the raft, but the soldier told them what to do until he was strong enough to take an oar himself. On the second day after the fight, he and Tomas were bending their bodies into the effort of wagging the oars of the raft behind it, pushing it forward just that little bit faster than the current, telling stories and sharing jokes. "What will you do with yourself?" Tomas asked.
"I'll keep on for Avignon. I'll sign on for the new crusade."
Tomas's face soured at the memory of the knight and his retinue that passed them close to Auxerre. A devil and a host of the dead.
"Some face you pull. Do you not love the thought of Jerusalem in Christian hands again? It might be just the thing to quench God's wrath at us."
"About that," Tomas said. "What have we done to make God so mad at us? What have we done that our fathers and their fathers did not do?"
"They were punished too. The year I was born, the famine near made my mother's milk dry."
"It can't have been that bad. Look at the size of you." But it was that bad, and Tomas remembered it well. For nearly 5 years, when he was first a page and then a squire, the crops drowned in the rain and murrains killed the beasts, a hanged man had disappeared from the gibbet, and everyone knew the farmers on the edge of town had eaten him. Only the kindness of Tomas's senior had kept his family from taking such desperate measures. Père Mathieu drew closer, waiting for his chance to join the conversation. The girl ate a salted fish and stared at the water.
"We have famine too," Tomas rejoined, "on top of war and pestilence. How are we so wicked as to deserve all of this?"
"Well, you may not be wicked, but I'm wicked enough for both of us."
"If you were wicked, I'd be in that river. All of us would. You're a good man, Guillaume."
"That wasn't goodness, that was fellowship."
"Martial camaraderie," said the priest.
"Fellowship will do," said Guillaume,
nodding his head at the priest as if to say, "Can you believe him?" Then Tomas was struck funny and laughed, looking not at the priest, but at Guillaume. The priest laughed too.
"What?"
the big-armed man asked. Tomas said,
"I should trim that last stitch. When you jerked your head, it stuck straight up. You look like a sour apple with a little stem."
His face flushed red, though he was smiling.
"And you look like..."
"What?" Tomas dared him.
"The ass of..."
"The ass of what?" The soldier thought for a moment.
"Something I wouldn't want to walk behind."
Even the girl laughed at that.
"Even if we are wicked," Tomas said,
but the soldier cut him off.
"Everyone is wicked."
"What about her?" Tomas said, pointing a thumb at Delphine.
"Well, I don't know her, do I? She doesn't look rotten, but she could be. Or maybe she will be later. Everyone sins. Isn't that right, Father?"
"Undoubtedly,"
Père Mathieu said, with some enthusiasm, glad the men had moved from martial stories about camp and training, though never Crécy, to something he knew how to talk about.
"Man is born into sin, all because of Adam."
Guillaume said,
"Mostly Eve, my priest told us."
Delphine looked up from the water now.
"That's not fair."
"How's that?"
said Guillaume.
"She was tempted by something stronger than her. Adam was tempted by a weaker creature, or so we are told. If Eve was his inferior, his sin was greater. You can't have it both ways."
"Huh," the priest said, trying to knock the rust off his rhetoric, but failing to find the proper argument.
"I told you everyone was wicked," said the soldier. "Her sin is that she goes against the teachings of the church."
The priest said,
"May not a man be tempted by a sinful child?"
As we are now, laughed the soldier.
The girl thought, absently fingering the scab on her chin, and said,
Yes, but what of a child tempted by a sinful man?
As Guillaume was in the field by an uncle, two uncles, Thomas said.
Don't be crude, she said. This is important. Is the child misled by the man more sinful than the man misled by a child?
I should have warned you her father was a lawyer, said Thomas. Are you not her father? Christ, no. I'd have shaken that out of her. It's never too late, said Guillaume. Oh, I fear it is.
You haven't answered the question, Delphine said.
I'm just going to pull my whoring oar, said the man. Me too, said the knight.
Are men who swear foul oaths during a conversation about God fit to point out sin in someone else?
Said the girl. And she ate her fish right down to the tail, looking more than a little proud of herself. At the end of the third day after the fight, just at dusk, they came to a dam in the river. At first it seemed to be something men had made with logs, but as they drew closer, it became clear that the obstruction was composed mostly of dead cows, sheep, and the bodies of men and women. Dead fish, heaps of them, also glittered in the last of the sunlight.
How the Christ are we to get around that? Thomas said.
Guillaume shook his head.
Shit, what is it? You know, this river.
The big-armed man shrugged his shoulders. The raft drew closer. One of the cows moved now, but not of its own power. Something under it had shifted, causing it to lurch in the water and bump against the other flotsam.
I think we should pull to the shore, the soldier said,
and the priest said,
Yes, yes, please.
They turned the oars, and the raft turned a little, but just kept heading for the island of dead things. They wrenched the oars with all their strength now, leaning back, but still the raft moved downriver, though it faced diagonally. Something was pulling it. The girl whimpered and took up the flute-shaped box around her neck, opening the tiny hinges. The priest crossed himself and looked over the side. Something white bobbed in the water, not far below the surface, and it seemed as though something viscous and opaque had formed itself into long ropes. That was what had the raft. That was what reeled it in. Other white things bobbed as well. One of them now rushed past the vessel, and the priest saw it was a sheep's head. But the head was encased in a kind of gelatinous creature, the size and shape of a large basket. It pulsed itself to move, opening and closing itself like a flower, its rim fringed with reddish-purple tendrils that trailed behind it.
God preserve us, please, please, Père Mathieu said.
The men at the oars stopped trying to use them to move the boat and came to look at what the priest was gaping at. Now several of the jellied things pulsed underwater around the raft, seeming to glow with their own faint light. At the center of each of them was the head of a man, woman, beast, or child. The raft lurched against the dam of bodies, none of which had heads attached. Thomas looked at the nearer shore and removed his helm and chain hood. Guillaume, seeing his intention, began to help him off with his surcoat, but it was too late. One of the things flopped onto the raft. The head in the middle of this one was decomposed, but not so much they could not tell. Its filmy eyes were set too far apart and looking in different directions. It pulsed and slithered forward, its frill of tentacles waving in the air now. Thomas lashed at it with his sword, but it parted around his blade and did not suffer. The girl tried to touch it with her spear, but it twitched away from her, one of its frills brushing her wrist in riposte. It stung her. She cried out in pain and nearly dropped the spear. That brief caress had burned like touching a hot coal. The priest pulled her back. Now another one, with an old woman's head at the middle of it, flowed up from the river onto the raft. Yellowish tentacles, presumably from a much larger cousin of theirs, began to rise up from below and wrap themselves around the raft, causing a corner of it to dip under water. Desperate, Tomas writhed out of his surcoat, but the chain hauberk was still on him, threatening to pull him down like so many bricks if he went over. He had no time. The tendrils yanked harder, pulling the raft at a sharper angle, causing some of their cargo to slide forward. A case of weapons slid into the water. Now the wrapped salt cases were moving too. Salt! The priest ran for the salt and began working at the twine that kept the oiled cover on it. Delphine backed up, lashing at the first horrid thing with her spear, though she missed and was stung every time. Her wrist had swollen, and she could barely feel her hand. Worse than its stings were its words. It spoke to her, and even though the mouth of the captain's head moved in its viscous host, she wasn't sure if the voice was only in her thoughts or not.
"I am Carolus. That was a gift from Carolus Carolus. And what is your name? You'll tell me when I take your head under with me to the beautiful, the lightless bottom of the sea, where the drowned will marry us."
Guillaume grabbed an axe and hacked at the jaundiced ropes hauling the raft under, but some of these lashed about and stung him too. Tomas sidestepped the second of the jellied things, which were not graceful out of water, and saw what the priest was doing. He stepped over and cut the twine. The priest opened a sack and flung it now, hoping he was right about its properties. The properties of salt. He was. The one he salted twitched and recoiled at the first grains of the desiccant, and, when showered with a proper fistful, browned and died, melting from around the stinking head of the woman, which now lay still and dead. Tomas sheathed his sword and opened two sacks, grabbing one in each fist. He hurled these at the monster that was hurting Delphine, and it too hissed and died its second death, leaving the captain's head open-mouthed in a rictus of betrayal and pain. The sun was long gone now, and the gloaming was upon them. The water shone with phosphorescence. It would have been impossible to count the number of them moving about in the river.
"Salt!" Tomas yelled to Guillaume. "Salt the bastard that's sinking us!"
He turned now and ran for the sacks, as Tomas also went to grab more. But a fresh bloom of tentacles rose from the river and lashed the fore of the raft, pulling it so sharply that the salt, the weapons, the fish, the men, and the girl all went into the cold water. They plunged into the river, which was mercifully shallow here, having flattened out to flow around the dam as best it could, perhaps 30 yards from the shore. At once, the priest grabbed for Delphine and made for the bank, half swimming and half stumbling on the bottom. At the same time, Guillaume put himself under Tomas and hoisted him to help keep his head above water. They got 10 yards before the things realized where they were, and the stinging began again. The large one, visible now that night had come, shone dimly as a sort of luminous, greyish-white sail in the middle of the dead island. It could not move from the deeper middle of the run, but it sent out long strands of its underside, trying to wrap them around the fleeing men and the fleeing child, which it wanted most. Its tendrils smoked and broke when she touched them with her stinger, but the smaller swimmers were stinging them dead. Tomas lived because his armor and surcoat protected him from the worst of the stings. Delphine lived because the priest used his body to shield her. Guillaume was taken. He had been pushing Tomas forward, but the things had stung his submerged groin and legs countless times, and he fell behind, jerking now with every sting. 3 or 4 of them crowded around him now and brushed him all over with their frills. The poison in him stopped his heart. He went still and sank. The tentacles from the big one webbed him now,
They pulled his head from him and reeled it back into itself, where a new swimmer would be made. Guillaume's body was pulled into the island. Tomas, unaware of Guillaume's fate and mad to get out of the river, strode through the shallower water now, bulling forward so as not to slip under. He caught up with the envenomed priest, who was barely moving, his remaining force going to his arms, which held the girl up and out of the water. She had passed out. She was dead weight, and yet he held her. The knight would never forget the image of the faltering priest holding the girl up. How like the raising of the Eucharist it looked. Tomas, kicking one of the swimmers out of the way, grabbed the priest's belt, hauling him the last yards to the shore. The priest wanted to fall, but Tomas would not let him. Not until they reached a small road by the river, crossed that, and made their way to a field gone fallow and wild with lavender bushes past their flowering. They were almost in Provence. When the men and the girl were clear of the water, the tentacles from the thing in the island whipped around furiously, making a small rain fall around it, and, from below, a ghastly moaning came from the submerged and captive mouths of the dead. It was supposed to take the girl. It would be punished. The island bobbed and shifted and moved south as the abomination in its middle dragged its prizes down the run and to the sea. 24. Of the cottage and of the song. Tomas took the girl from Père Mathieu, hoisting her over his shoulder in the same way that Jaco had so long ago on that rainy afternoon in Normandy. The knight pulled the priest along by the arm for as far as the cleric could walk, which was not far. He was struggling to breathe, and his face had swollen so badly his eyes had shut. He looked dead already. He collapsed in a field, not far from a house, where the light of a hearth fire danced behind closed shutters. Tomas, dripping and cold in his armor, laid the girl down next to the priest. He knew they would both need warmth. He must go to the house, and he must hurry. But the priest sounded as if he were choking, even now. Tomas stripped down to his shirt and breeches, and propped Père Mathieu's head up as best he could with the soaked gambeson he wore beneath his chainmail, and that seemed to help. The priest poured the air blindly with one shaking hand, and Tomas squeezed it. "Don't die, bugger," he said. Now picking up the girl and sloshing through the high grass and wildflowers toward the cottage. Dogs barked at him from inside, and he heard a goat bleat as well. A shadow blocked the firelit gaps in the shutters as someone inside peeked at him. He held the girl out as if she were his bond of peace. "I am unarmed. I need help."
"Are you sick?"
an old man said.
"No." "Well, I am. I buried my last son yesterday, and today I can't stop sneezing. I know what that means."
"I'm not afraid."
"Neither am I."
"Our ship sank in the river. My daughter will die without warmth."
"She'll die if she comes in here like as not. There's a horse blanket in the stable, if nobody's taken it."
"I want to bring her near the fire. Please."
"Your choice," he said, and drew the bolt, letting the door swing wide.
The goat ran out but stayed near the house. The dogs whimpered and barked uncertainly until their master kicked them, which was what he always did to show them a visitor was safe. So they stopped and settled near the fire, one of them half-heartedly wagging her tail. They were kicked again to clear a spot for the girl, who was waking up now. She whimpered.
"What happened to your faces?"
the old man said. "River. Something in it stung us." He looked at the old man now, with his fine white hair plastered to his head, and saw the sorrow in his eyes, and the sag of the skin around them. The man looked grey. The man looked sick.
"Stung you? I've fished that river 50 years and nothing ever stung me.
I'll talk later. Our priest dies tonight, but not in a field. The old man looked Tomas over, but then sighed, concluding that he had nothing to lose by trusting him. Death at this giant's hands would be kinder than what would come in a day or two, and it would be nice to see a priest.
Bring him, then.
The old man sneezed 3 times in a row and crossed himself as Tomas limped off into the darkness beyond the door. The female dog licked the priest's face. Tomas went to push it away, but Delphine pointed at the priest's mouth, which bore a hint of a smile, so Tomas acceded. He wondered how long the man had left. He had thrown up violently, and now he couldn't stop shaking. Worse, he fought for every breath. But he did not cry out.
You might not have been a soldier, bugger, but you're tough.
Stop calling him that,
said the girl. Tomas turned an angry glance at her, but softened it immediately.
Yes.
He put his hand on the priest's chest. The priest fought one of his slitted eyes open and looked at the knight. Then he looked up and past him, pointing at something on the wall. A lute hung diagonally, covered in dust, near several upside-down bouquets of dried flowers. Tomas turned now to the old man and said, Do you play?
I did,
he said, holding up 2 hands with gnarled fingers.
I thought I wanted to be a troubadour, and by then I married.
Can you play at all?
Maybe a little.
The old man clambered onto a stump and pulled the instrument down from its pegs, blowing a plume of dust off it. He tried to tune it, but couldn't manage with his wrecked fingers. He plucked a few sour strings and limped through half a Provençal love song, singing in his croaking voice. Then he couldn't stand the sound of himself anymore, and he stopped. He sneezed, wincing, putting his finger to his neck and feeling for the first time the exquisitely painful acorn-sized lump there.
And so, he said,
letting the lute dangle from his hand. He looked at the man dying by the fire, and at the sadness in the knight's face, and he thought about the shallow graves near the lavender. All he could do was to chuckle without humor, coughing as he did, shaking his head at the lies he'd believed in his youth about God's love and mercy. At least there might be someone to bury him now, in the lavender, near all that he had loved. The girl held out her hand for the lute. He narrowed his eyes. She seemed half asleep, and he knew no young girls who played. Yet, when he handed it to her, she tuned it expertly.
I had no idea, Tomas said,
but she ignored him and he was silent. She played. She sang. It was a song Tomas dimly remembered from his wedding feast, when his wife's eyes looked so kindly upon him. He had thrown a handful of sweetened nuts into his mouth, and his new, heavy ring had hit his tooth, making him swear, making her laugh. The whole table had laughed. From that day forward, 3 taps of her ring on anything meant, Do you remember our wedding day? And 3 taps on his part meant, God, yes. He recalled it all quite sharply. The smell of bergamot in her hair, the whiteness of her neck, her eyes pear green, how sweet the marriage bed had been. How, even after years of amorous tusslings with camp women and kitchen girls, he had stood nervously while the old women took the ribbons off his verge, looking at this beauty whose pale, lovely belly was his to put children in, and whose mouth was his to kiss for as long as she lived. Or, as it turned out, until he left for war. The old man knew this song, too. It was the one he had learned in Valence, his 17th year, in the music teacher's studio above a candle shop, where those gorgeous sounds had married themselves to the smell of tallow, such that even 50 years later He could not smell candles in church without being transported. It was this song, more than any other, that made him want to travel with his lute. It was this one he played to seduce the chestnut-haired girl whose pregnancy anchored him on this little patch of land forever. The priest also remembered the song. He had heard it just before he went to take orders, when the bishop's personal musician came to the Lord's castle and hushed the room with it, making it seem possible to Matcher that a greater world lay beyond the disappointment of his father and the vanity of his brother. A world where God's love was unfiltered by priests or texts, and could be had freely by looking up at the sky, or hearing a man sing. It was a promise of joy he would not feel again until the May before the great death came, a joy made even brighter by how swiftly it was seized back again, how much it cost him. It had never occurred to him that a female voice might animate those fondly remembered lyrics even more sweetly than that long-ago minstrel in the bishop's train, but now it did. The next 2 days would be hard. Tomas would dig Père Mathieu's grave as their host burned with fever and lost his reason. He would pull Mathieu from under the arms while his feet dragged and the girl cried, and he got a last noseful of the priest's woolly, whiny, lonely smell. The following day, Tomas would dig another grave and lay the old man in it without ever learning his name, though he knew the name of the wife, because it was to her the old man addressed his last words. On the third day, he and the girl would make for Avignon, pulling the little goat on a rope, trying to call the dogs to follow them. But the male would stay whimpering in his master's house, and the female would lie on his grave, wagging her tail at them until their forward motion eclipsed her behind a stand of goldenrod. That would be tomorrow. For this moment, all three men remembered the best hours of their lives. When the song finished, the priest spoke.
"The river,"
he said, and Tomas thought he meant the run, the one that had killed him.
"River froze last winter. Saw you on skates of horses' shin bones, and now, so white. Your legs, not red at all."
Tomas understood now.
"Moon's light on you."
He wanted to turn his gaze away at this talk of love between men, but couldn't. He knew it was the last he would see of this flawed priest who had become so dear to him so quickly. This was harder than the Comte's death. For all his goodness, the Comte was not gentle. He was of this world and of the brutality of the world. This man, Mathieu Anicot, seemed to have been misplaced here. He hoped there was wine in his heaven. Could a sodomite attain to heaven? He remembered the priest holding the girl up out of the water as the abominations stung the life from him. Hoc est corpus meum. If that was not good enough, nothing would be.
"Robert,"
he said now, grabbing Tomas's hand.
"Tomas,"
the knight said in the husky voice of one fighting with tears.
"I am Tomas."
"No. Find Robert. Tell him."
"Who's Robert?"
"My brother. Tell him."
"Tell him what?"
The priest worked one eye open again and looked at Tomas, breathing with great difficulty.
"What do you want me to tell him?"
The priest smiled.
"I don't know,"
he said. He breathed 3 more hard breaths, each one longer in coming. And then he stopped. Tomas had seen so many die that his hand moved with the reflex to close the priest's eyes, but they were already glued shut for good.
play another song, would you?
The old man said. Delphine looked up at him, surprised he was looking at her. He repeated himself, and she looked down at the instrument in her lap as though it had just appeared there. Her tears fell on its face.
Play us something sad and sweet.
Go on, the knight said. I don't think his soul's so far above us yet.
She gave them a look and a sad smile that puzzled the old man, but Tomas had seen enough from her to understand. She doesn't know how. It wasn't her who played. Later that night, while the old man and Tomas stole a few hours' sleep, Delphine went to Mathieu's cold body. She put her finger below his nose and felt nothing. She sensed herself on the verge of some great blasphemy, but felt so angered at the sweet priest's death that she didn't care if she made God angry now. It would serve him right.
I can't think like that, she prayed. Let me do this, please. Work through me.
She pried open the priest's waxy mouth and breathed into it, as if she were God himself breathing life into Adam's dead clay. Nothing. She tried to conjure the feeling of the sparrow fluttering in her chest, and she thought she did, but wasn't sure. She sensed that she could almost do this, that with just a little help.
Is this a sin?
Delphine breathed into his mouth again. His big, cool hand, into which she had slipped her fingers, squeezed hers gently. Her heart beat like a rabbit's in her chest. She almost laughed with joy. And then the hand relaxed.
No!
She breathed into his mouth again. Nothing.
Please, she thought. He's so good. I need him. Please, I love him.
Now the fluttering, different from her racing heart. Now her answer.
Leave him with us, little moon. You're not strong enough for that. Not yet.
She shook her head against this denial. She blew into the dead man's mouth a dozen more times, but his fingers never moved again. And when she began to have the feeling she was troubling him, she went to a corner and sobbed until she washed the whites out of her eyes. 25. Of Delphine and of the Scarecrow. Delphine traced her fingers on the sleeping knight's face. Tomas, 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 Tomas. She touched him lightly enough that she knew he would not stir. He slept like a soldier, always set to spring awake at a strange sound, but he seemed to know it was her hand upon his face, and that she was no threat to him.
But I am.
The land was drier now, rockier, warmer. The sky blazoned its unquenchable Provençal blue over plain trees with yellow-green leaves and bark like linen. It had not rained since they left the old man's house, and the vines were still green here. They had stopped in a shallow cave near a stream, exhausted after 2 days on foot. They had sold the goat to a Provençal family the day before, Tomas gesturing his way through much of the exchange, getting in return a hot meal and a small pouch of silver that wouldn't get them far. Tomas had told her flatly that he intended to steal the first horse they saw, but they saw horses only when troops of men, sometimes soldiers, sometimes laborers, headed south and past them. It had not seemed plausible that any of these groups would turn their horses over to one man, no matter how big and dangerous he looked. So Tomas stole nothing. It wasn't going to work like this. She had been thinking about it for days as they walked. She had prayed, and prayed hard for a dream to tell her what to do. In the dream, she saw the city of Avignon lying before her, a little below her as if she were a bird. and then the city filled with birds that flew about and ate a multitude of flies. She did not see herself or Tomas, nor did she have any sense of what she was supposed to do there. It made her angry. She tried to imagine what her father would do, but she already knew, and it scared her. Her father would not want to bring harm to another. How many were gone now because of her? Annette and her husband, the soldier on the raft. And now funny, sad-eyed Père Mathieu, even an angel of God. This was not counting the three men Tomas had slain. Her father would not bring this night any farther to kill, or, worse, get killed himself. And what was she becoming now, to think it better if Tomas killed another than that any harm should come to him? That was the way everyone thought, protecting the beloved at the cost of the stranger. She would go on alone. Her fingers lingered just below his nostrils, and the feel of his living breath pleased and thrilled her. If God wanted her in Avignon, he would have to get her there safely, without using Tomas, and then casting him away when he was no longer needed. Am I tempting God or doing his will? Mother Mary, help me. She climbed to the top of a rocky outjut full of ochre and crowned with thorny bushes, and bushes whose leaves flashed silver undersides when the wind blew. And the wind did blow here, not quite cool, but neither warm, just hard. She gathered her new horse blanket, the one from the old man's stable, around her shoulders. A mountain rose to the south, slightly blurred with haze, protected by a pack of smaller, sharp mountains that seemed ready to intercept anyone who tried to approach the large one. She saw the Rhône snaking south to her right, deceptively blue. Come get your raft, dear. Follow me to the city of your dying. She wanted to cry, but pushed that down and lifted her chin. Her shoes were nearly worn through. The road that had been punishing her feet lay close to the river. Romans made that. How do I know this? I'm becoming something. She turned now and looked for Tomas, conflicted about whether she hoped to see him. She knew he would be following her. There was no mystery about where she was going. But she was sure she had a long head start. Her heart sank just a little to see that the road behind her was empty. She wanted to play her bird flute, but it had fallen out of her pouch in the river. Her mother's comb had not, and she put it to her lips now, blowing through its teeth, but unable to get anything like music out of it. She walked on. As late afternoon came on, she found a pretty little farmhouse, roofed with the lazy U-shaped tiles they used here. Whoever had been here must have left. She found nothing in the house but furniture and tools. She went to the well in the back, her throat parched, and started lowering the bucket. She stopped, though, when she first smelled, then saw how rancid the well was. Very little water pooled in that well, not at all enough to cover a man's mostly skeletal remains bunched at the bottom, his back twisted so his skull and torso faced the wrong way, the eye sockets drilling up at her. An accident? Did people still die of those? Then she saw the child's skull, just the top and one eye visible, one small foot perched on a rock.
No. He threw the body in and jumped. May God forgive him, since he couldn't forgive God. Can I?
She crossed herself. Did the child's skull move? Were two eye pits now visible?
Join us. Tell us stories about the world where the sun shines all day.
She went back toward the road. The bucket's rope creaked. Her hand went to the flute-shaped box around her neck. She walked faster. She couldn't find any water near the road or in the several houses she visited. She did, however, spend nearly an hour crouching in a vineyard where the dark little grapes had missed their harvest time, some of them beginning to pucker at the stem. She stuffed her mouth with them, almost to the peril of her fingers, until she vomited, then slowed down, eating a little more and napping under an iron-wheeled cart. She got her strength back, but after another hour on the road, her thirst returned. Still no Tomas. She chided herself for looking. One house was occupied, its shutters flung wide, but two men quarreled there. She saw their shapes move in the darkness of the house, their angry, bearded faces illuminated in flashes as they circled each other and took turns passing through a swath of sunlight where roof tiles were missing. Likewise, she could understand only flashes of their southern language, which was like French, but not French.
Hit you! Yeah! Kill you! No! No! You! Mine! Christ! Last time!
She hugged the limestone wall near the house and kept on, tempted by their well, but not wanting to risk being seen. A skinny pig in an enclosure of twined together branches saw her and snuffed the air at her, but then rolled in the little bit of mud near its trough. She leaned over and stole a palmful of water from that trough, and then scurried on. Her thirst worsened. It was only when she was out of earshot that her fear gave way to pain and her limp returned. She went to the run an hour before sunset. She would want to be away from it before the sun slipped behind the hills. No bodies floated there, and no monsters shouldered up from the river's middle. She saw nothing but weeds on the sandy bottom near the shore. Half of a wrecked fishing boat, mudded in the shallows, looked to have been there a long time, perhaps since before the world and hell began to couple. The wind stung her with grit and chopped the surface of the river, but she knelt in the shallows, happy for the cool water lapping at her knees. She cupped her hands to her mouth and slurped, her lips stinging insignificantly just before she swallowed, and her cooled, slaked throat became the glad center of her awareness. She took off her stiff, almost formless shoes, delicately so as not to snap what was left of the thong that wrapped around her ankles, and put her feet in the water. It was good. She felt herself smiling for the first time since Père Mathieu died. Delphine started awake with the feeling that someone was watching her. She opened her eyes, but the night was so dark they were useless.
Where am I? Think. The old man's house?
No. She remembered now. The priest was dead and she had left Tomas. She was alone. But where?
The convent.
The wind whipped outside, moaning in little nooks of the stone building. She panted, scared of the dark, scared of her solitude. But someone was watching her. She was sure of it. Who or what could see in this pitch?
I hear you breathing, child.
A woman's voice, not unfriendly. But all the nuns in this little grotto convent were dead. She had seen them arranged in the garden, their faces wrapped tightly in cloths, nearly skeletal arms clasped as if in prayer, and wound with wooden rosaries. She remembered that several of these cadavers had no arms on them, but she had seen the human body so abused in so many ways in the last 3 months that she gave it no further thought. Despite the sadness in the garden, the building itself had been empty and had offered protection from the wind. She liked the stone cross over the chapel. But now, who was in the room with her?
You needn't breathe like a hunted thing. You rest in the arms of the Lord tonight.
She was in the chapel. She remembered now. An old stone dome near rows of lavender past its blooming time. And a palm tree. She had never seen a palm tree before. The wind made its leaves rattle, and it was browner than she thought a healthy one should be, though not from thirst, surely. It inclined gently toward a statue of Mary, with neither crown nor scepter nor babe.
"Who are you?"
the girl asked.
"A sister. Sister Broom, if you like. I clean up here. Will you light a lamp, sister?" "I haven't one. I see quite well in the dark. The older sisters, who did not see so well, have no need of lamps now."
Delphine forced herself to breathe more easily.
"That's better,"
the other said. She felt a hand on her chest, patting her as if in reassurance, but it seemed to be feeling its way toward what she carried around her neck. She shifted away from the hand. The hand was withdrawn.
"My, but you're a nervous little thing. Forgive me. I am. Forgive me." "What is it that you're so worried about?" "A gift. My father gave it to me." "I love gifts. What kind of gift is it?"
She struggled to see, but could make nothing out.
An instrument.
"Of song?"
"Yes." "May I see it?"
Delphine swallowed hard, trying to think of a response, but she couldn't. Then she remembered not to think at all, but just to speak and see what came out.
"My father told me not to let anyone touch it." "That's too bad. Well, I shouldn't be selfish. All the things of the convent are mine to amuse myself with now."
Delphine heard what sounded like a sack being dragged closer, and then the sound of someone fishing around in that sack.
"Here," the woman's voice said. "What do you imagine this is?"
An object was placed in Delphine's hand. It was round and thin and made of metal.
"A bracelet?" "Yes. The Mother Superior bought it with money from the convent treasury. She wore it over her elbow where the others could not see it, and looked at herself, nude, in a glass, imagining she was Salome. Can you imagine? It's silver with little grapevines and jeweled grapes on it. It was from the time when this place was called Gaul. I do wish I had a lamp. Can you feel the vines in the metal? They're exquisite, aren't they?"
Delphine grew afraid again and panted, but she managed to nod, not thinking about the darkness. She was seen.
"Clever thing,"
Sister Broom said. The hand was on her chest again, but she twisted away. The hand was withdrawn.
"But what is in that case?" "I want to go outside."
Silence. Delphine started to get to her feet. The woman's voice spoke before she stood.
"I'll be angry if you stand up."
She stayed sitting on her heels, sweating and trying not to pass out from fear, wishing she could see well enough to run somewhere.
Wasn't there a window in this place?
Yes, past the altar. She should at least be able to make out a window by the stars, unless clouds had come. Was the other in front of it?
"I don't want to make you angry." "And I don't want to be angry. We're friends, aren't we?" "As you say."
A hand moved again in the sack. Now a cold, round object went into Delphine's hand, the hand that placed it there brushing hers. Dry and cool.
"What is that, do you think?"
She struggled to control her breathing.
"A coin," Good. A piece of silver. One of 30 Judas received for the betrayal of the Nazarene. This convent kept it in a box of cedar, but the Mother Superior broke it and took it out, took it for herself. How selfish she was! Can you imagine what they'd pay for it in Avignon? Would you like to keep it? I'll give it to you for what's around your neck. No, she managed to mew. The coin belongs to you now.
The cold, dry hand took the coin back, and a sound like very dry hissing or rattling came from the other in the room.
May I please go outside now? Not unless you wish to end our friendship. Is that what you want? No. I agree. Let us be loving with each other. There's so little love anywhere.
Now another object was removed from the sack. She heard the sound of sawing near her. She smelled the dust of very old wood. Now the saw was placed in her hand.
I know you know what that is, but can you guess its significance? Something to do with the Mother Superior? Of course! She used this to build something very special before she left this place. Her lord told her to. Her new lord. Where is she? Now? Are you? No, child, you flatter me. I am not the Mother Superior. She went to Avignon. Or that's where she thought she was going. But as she packed her sack, what she made came to life. It had orders of its own to follow. She is still here now, part of her at least, and that part is past vanity and greed.
Delphine shivered now and could not stop. This thing was going to kill her. She reached for the case and began to open its tiny latches.
If you open that case, I'll bite your fucking thumbs off.
She withdrew her hands.
Now give it to me.
Something occurred to Delphine. Her breathing calmed.
Why don't you take it?
She said, her voice trembling. Silence.
You wouldn't like that very much. Well, I don't like being threatened very much either. I repeat my question. If you're capable of hurting me, why do you ask me for what you want? Why not just take it? Because that wouldn't be friendly.
Delphine took a deep breath. When she spoke again, her voice was steady.
Friends don't terrorize one another. If you're really my friend, leave me in peace.
The rattling hiss came. The thing in the room dropped the pretense of human voice.
Give me that fucking case.
I refuse.
Something bit in front of her face. The smell of mold and dust and stale death washing over her. Delphine stood up now. Hands groped and clutched at her, more than two hands. But she pushed them off and stood up anyway. Now she opened the case and took the spearhead out. The thing scuttled back with a dry, scratching sound.
I believe you are only able to do to me what I permit. I forbid you to touch me again.
The room now exploded in a fury of flung objects as something moved around the room, banging on the altar, punching what glass was left out of the windows, and a dry scream bounced off the walls, hurting Delphine's ears. She felt her way to the door and stepped out into the wind. The stars were out, and she could see well enough to walk toward a tree. She climbed it, the spear in her teeth, and found a branch she could sleep on. It followed her outside and to the base of the tree, but it had drawn around itself her blanket, which she had forgotten inside, and she could not see what it was. She thought she saw a blackened face and a wisp of hair.
"You stupid Norman cunt! You'll die in your sleep tonight, and fall from that tree like rotten fruit."
"I will not fall, and you will not be here in the morning. There are wicked things strong enough to harm me, but you are not one of them. You're a scarecrow. You are made of lies, and you are not made well. I feared you, but now I pity your suffering. Good night."
The only sound that answered Delphine was the wind in the leaves around her. By and by, she slept. In the morning, she saw her blanket at the bottom of the tree. A profanity of sorts lay atop it, but a very sad one, made from a broom, three cross sticks, and the missing arms from the nuns in the garden. A skull, crowned with reddish-grey hair, sat atop the broom. She dragged the blanket over to the garden, then took the thing apart, using the saw she found in the chapel to cut the twine that bound it together. She put the human remains in the garden and said an Ave Maria over them. She used the broom to sweep the chapel out and then leaned it against the chapel door. Delphine shook out her blanket and put it around her shoulders, walking down the road that led to Orange, and then to the city of the Pope.
26. Of Thomas, and of an oath long overdue. The girl was gone. The knight looked around their camp for signs that she had been taken, but found nothing. He was sure she had left. She had barely spoken since the priest's death, and he believed she blamed him for it.
"We'll pay for that,"
she had said when he cut the raftsman's throat, and he was sure she had decided the priest's death was ordained from the moment Thomas broke her commandment not to kill. He wasn't sure she was wrong. Yet he could not bring himself to regret finishing that wretched, murderous walleye.
"God damn it,"
he said, feeling truly lost for the first time since this had all begun. Who was he now, without his pack of brigands, without that girl and her visions, without a coat of arms on his chest, or a horse, or the first whoring idea what he might do if he never saw her again?
"God damn it!"
Thomas called for her a dozen times or more, but then his voice went hoarse, fighting the dry wind, and he set off down the road, heading south. If he took big steps, he just might pass her. When the big, dirty soldier saw anyone at all, he asked,
"Have you seen a girl?"
The first response he got, other than a shrug, or a quick flight up a hill, or into the shadows of a thicket, was from a Provençal with a deeply lined face. The man nodded, slowly got up from the shadow of his house, and went inside, fetching out a homely teenager who pouted her lips at Thomas, despite the fact that she was nursing a large infant. There was no fixing the misunderstanding. From then on, Thomas said,
"I'm looking for my daughter. Have you seen a young blonde girl?"
But those were too many words for the others he caught sight of. They either cupped a hand to an ear and shook their heads, or else they fired their own language back at him, causing him to cup his hand and shake his head. He passed a large ochre rock covered in scrub, and then a small village. Two bearded men sat on the ground outside a house with missing roof tiles, one of them whittling a stick with a knife, the other sitting far away from him, holding a bloody cloth to his face and glaring at Thomas as he passed. A pig slept in the sun nearby. He kept walking into the evening, past a convent with a garden full of long-dead nuns, and then to a gully, where he lay down and slept until just before sunrise. The castle on the hill near Mornar flew the cross-key ensign that announced it belonged to the Pope. When he tried to approach the walled city, he was shouted away without even the chance to ask about the girl.
God damn it!
As he turned his back on Mornar, he heard bells ringing in the south. He found out why within the hour. His first thought, upon seeing the crowd gathered in the street of the next village he came to, was that the plague must be over here. Although he had seen a great many desiccated cadavers in Provence, he had not seen a fresh body in some time, and these people were standing near one another with no apparent concern for contagion. As he drew closer, he saw that there were, in fact, fresh bodies here. A dozen or so of them laid out in front of the church. These were not plague victims, though. They bled. A priest bent over one on the end, removing an arrow that looked to have stuck the young man's liver. A very long arrow. Several of the mourners saw Tomas now, and began to shout and point. This was not just a group of villagers. It was a group of furious villagers. It was a mob.
Oh, whore, he said.
There were too many to fight, and he was too encumbered to run. Mostly women and old men, too. This would be a hell of a way to die. He showed them his hands. An old man grabbed one of these and jerked him toward the bodies. He pulled away, but then several sets of hands grabbed him, and he allowed himself to be pulled and pushed along. A woman whose eyes blazed wide with grief and hate dipped her hand in a young corpse's wound and rubbed blood on Tomas's face.
"Wait! I haven't done anything!"
he said, though he wasn't sure they could hear him through the shouts.
"I did not kill these men!"
He was hit several times, once with the end of a rake, and a remarkably quick little boy took Tomas's sword from his sheath, running away with it, its edge making sparks on the ground. Another man now shouted at the crowd and moved his hands in a gesture to suggest calm, although he still held in one hand the arrow he had just pulled from a dead man. It was their priest. Despite his predicament, Tomas suddenly missed Père Mathieu so badly he almost sobbed. The crowd stopped its jeering.
"You are from France?"
the cleric said.
"Yes."
"Not English?"
"No. Picardy. I'm from Picardy," he said, careful to enunciate every syllable, pointing back up the road that led north.
"You are come for crusade?"
"I am looking for my daughter. Have you seen a strange girl? A blonde girl?"
The priest's eyes narrowed, and he shook his head, suspicious of distraction.
"You are not with these English Houthier," he said now,
showing Tomas the bloody arrow. Priest or not, he looked capable of shoving it into Tomas's eye.
"No," Tomas said solemnly. "I swear it."
An old man, his cheeks soaked with tears, said something to the priest and pointed at the church. The priest nodded.
"You make your oath in church!"
Tomas knelt. The priest stood before him.
"Are you a knight of France?"
"I am."
"Swear it."
"Yes, I do so swear."
"By Saint Michael and Saint Denis?"
"By Saint Michael and Saint Denis. I swear that I am a knight."
"Are you a knight turned routier, brigand?"
"No."
"Swear it."
"I swear I am no brigand, nor taker of men's goods, nor of their lives. I swear that I am a loyal knight of France, servant to God and to the king, and a friend to Provence."
"These men who come with the long bows, they are routier. If you see them and you are able, you give them God's justice? You will find others and give them justice?"
"Yes, I swear it."
The priest motioned for Tomas to stand, and he did so. Now the holy man made an announcement to the crowd. Many nodded, and some stepped forward to clap the knight's shoulder. The boy brought his sword back, his father at his arm, the point well off the ground. Tomas wiped it with the tail of his gambeson and sheathed it. Before he left, women sat him down and pulled off his boots. His feet and face were washed for him. He was offered a pot of lukewarm chicken stew, redolent with garlic and leeks, and so thick the wooden spoon stuck straight up out of it. He ate it all. He stood tall as he walked toward the town of Orange. Even in his all-but-ruined chainmail, even with his tattered boots and his sweat- and rust-stained gambeson, his bearing made him look more like a knight than he had in years. A hare crossed the road in front of him. He laughed.